This is a reading of a collection of lectures on bees by Rudolf Steiner, given to the workmen at the Gertianum. Lecture 1, given at Dornach, November 26th, 1923. Good morning, gentlemen. I intended to make several comments regarding Mr. Müller's explanations. Footnote: this lecture was given after a report by Mr. Müller, a beekeeper. End of footnote. You might find these comments interesting, although there naturally would not be enough time to really apply such things in apiculture in a practical way at the present time. Since Mr. Müller has presented everything you need to know in such a fine manner, a manner frequently employed today, there's really not much more, if anything at all, to be said about the practical aspects of beekeeping. Perhaps you noticed something about the entire nature of beekeeping. Something, I would say, of the nature of an enigma. The beekeeper is understandably interested above all in what must be done. Actually, every human being should show the greatest interest in this subject, because much more than you can imagine, our lives depend upon beekeeping. Let's look at this matter from a broader perspective. You see, bees, if you remember Mr. Müller's lectures, are capable of gathering what is already contained in the plants as nectar. In reality, they collect only the nectar, and we, as human beings, take only a part, not even a very large part, of what they collect in their hives. You could perhaps state that the amount removed by humans is approximately 20%. This is how much we take away from the bees. Besides this, however, the bee can remove pollen from the plants because of its body shape and the way it is organized as an insect. The bee collects from the plants that very thing which is uncommon and difficult to procure. By means of little brushes located on its hind legs, the bee collects the comparatively small amount of pollen available to it, and then either stores or eats it in the beehive. In the specific case of the bee, we have an animal that collects and uses in its household this substance that has been prepared by nature to be in an extraordinarily refined state. Let's continue. After the bee, and this is perhaps the least apparent feature, because people don't think of this at all, has transformed the food in its digestive system into wax, parenthesis, this wax the bee makes by itself, parenthesis, it creates a small vessel to deposit eggs, but also to store its provisions. This little container is a great curiosity, I would say. This receptacle looks like this. From above, it's hexagonal. From the side, like this. And there's a drawing below, see Table 2 in the section of blackboard drawings, beginning on page 161. And on the one side, it is closed off like this. Into this receptacle, the bee places the eggs, and also the provisions. One is right next to another. These things fit together very well, so that in the honeycomb, by means of this plate with which one such cell, this is what it is called, is attached to another, the space in the honeycomb is used to its best possible advantage. If you ask just why it is that the bee can construct instinctively such an ingeniously shaped cell, people usually respond by saying that they do this to use space efficiently. Yes, this is also true. If you were to imagine any other form of cell, there would always be an empty space between cells somewhere. With this form, no such gap arises, but rather everything is compact, so that the space in the honeycomb is completely utilized. Well, that certainly is one reason. But it is not the only reason. Just consider the following. If the maggot or larva is in the cell, then it is completely closed off from the environment. You should not believe for even a moment that whatever exists somewhere in nature is without certain powers. This six-cornered little case, this six-sided shell, has energies within it. It would be quite a different situation if the larva were inside a sphere. The significance of being placed into such a hexagonal house has a very different effect on its contents. The larva internalizes these forms. In its body, it senses that, in its youth, while its body was as soft as it would ever be, it was in such a six-sided cell. Out of this same energy that it assimilates as a larva, it will, as an adult, produce such a cell out of itself. In it resides the energies that help the bee do all other kinds of work as well. The environment is the cause for everything the bee does externally. This is the first thing we have to pay attention to. But you have heard from the explanation Mr. Müller gave that there is yet another very remarkable fact. In the entire beehive, you find various types of cells. I think a beekeeper can easily tell the female worker bee cells apart from the male drone cells. That isn't very difficult, is it? An even easier task is to distinguish the worker and drone cells from the queen bee cells, because the latter do not have this form. Their form is actually more like a pouch. There are also very few of them in a beehive. The worker bees and drones develop in such six-sided cells, but the queens develop in a pouch, hence the latter do not take any notice of what such a many-sided environment means to the other bees. Add to that something else. To reach full maturity, the queen needs only 16 days. At that time, it is already a fully grown queen. A worker needs about 21 days, a longer period. You could say that nature uses more care in creating the final shape of workers than it does with queens. You'll see shortly that there is another reason for this. Well, so the workers need 21 days. The drones, which are used up fastest by the beehive, these male bees are killed when they have fulfilled their purpose, need 23 to 24 days. You see, this is an entirely new matter. The various bee types, queens, workers, drones, need a different number of days to achieve maturity. Well, gentlemen, with regard to these 21 days a worker needs to develop, there is something rather peculiar. 21 days is not a random number without any particular significance for all the things that happen here on Earth. 21 days is the approximate time span the sun needs to revolve once on its axis and return to the point where it can begin a new cycle. Just imagine, the worker bee's development is just barely completed at the same time that the sun has completed a single revolution on its axis. By following this cycle, gentlemen, the worker bee has experienced every different effect the sun can have on it, and all of these effects are now within the bee. If this process were to continue beyond 21 days, the workers would only receive more of the same and repeat that to which they had already been exposed. If you then imagine the worker here, a drawing on the blackboard, table 2, upper left, inner circle, and the sun over there, when the egg is laid, then this is the point that lies opposite the sun. The sun turns on its axis once in 21 days. Then it will arrive again at this point and begin repeating this movement. The worker uses from the sun just what it needs to achieve its full development. If the worker were to continue in its development beyond this point, it would leave the sun development and come into the sphere of influence that the earth would exert upon its development. It would thus lose its sun development because it had already completed it and enjoyed it to its fullest capacity. The way it is now, the worker enters into earth development and experiences it only as an already completely developed animal, having achieved its full maturity at 21 days. At most, it needs to experience only, I would say, a moment of earth development for itself. After this, the worker is cut off from further development and is a sun animal, containing the results of all the possible effects that the sun can have upon such a form of animal life. Now consider the drone. It doesn't feel, as I would put it, that it is completed at 21 days and wants to continue into the earth development phase before it is finished maturing. It is definitely an earth animal, while the worker is a sun child, complete within itself. And what about the queen bee? It doesn't even finish the entire sun cycle of 21 days. It lags behind and remains forever a sun child. The queen lingers to a certain degree in its larval stage, or at least closer to this stage than the other bees. The drones have distanced themselves farthest of all from this larval stage. Because the queen remains closer to the larval stage, it is capable of laying eggs. With bees, you can really see what it means to be under the influence of the earth or of the sun, depending upon whether a bee waits to complete the sun development phase. It will turn out to be a queen, a worker, or a drone. The queen can lay eggs because the sun effect is always within it, and it hasn't anything at all of the earth's effect upon development. The worker continues its development for 4 or 5 days longer. It makes use of every influence the sun has to offer, but then it enters slightly, for just a moment, into the earth's development's sphere of influence. Just at a point when its body has become hard enough. Because it has absorbed itself completely, it can't return to the sun development's influence. This is why it can't lay eggs. The drones are fertile males. This fertilization capability comes from the earth. The drones acquire the power to fertilize from the few days longer they are exposed as incomplete insects to the influence of earth development. This leads us to the conclusion that with bees, you can see clearly that the male's fertilization powers come from the energies given by the earth, whereas the female capability to develop eggs derives from the sun's energies. You see, gentlemen, you can comprehend the great significance of the particular length of time that a being needs to develop. During a certain period, something occurs that does not happen in a shorter or longer period, but in a shorter or longer period something else happens. There is one more thing to consider. The queen develops in 16 days. Here is its point of complete development. There's a drawing on the blackboard, table 2, upper left, outer circle, that it took as it stood opposite the sun. It remains within the period of sun development. The workers complete this sun rotation period, but they remain within the sphere of the sun's influence and do not enter the earth development phase. Because they belong to the same sun development cycle, they feel related to the queen. They feel themselves tied to the queen. The drones, they say, are traitors. They have already split away from the group and have fallen to earth. They no longer belong with them. They only tolerate them because they need them. And what do they need them for? It sometimes happens that a queen is not fertilized, and nevertheless lays eggs capable of development. The queen does not need to be fertilized in all instances. She will lay eggs anyhow. This is called, in the instance of bees, a virgin brood. The queen has not been fertilized. Some other insects are capable of doing the same. Parthenogenesis is the scientific term for it. But from the eggs that are laid in this way, only drones will hatch. If the queen is not fertilized, no more worker bees and queen bees can be produced, only drones. Such a beehive has no practical use. You can see that with a virgin brood, only the opposite sex can arise, never the same sex. That is a very interesting fact, a fact that is very important for maintaining nature's entire household. Fertilization is necessary so that the same sex will be reproduced. Naturally, only in the lower animals, not in the higher ones. That's why it is that out of bee eggs, only drones can be created if no fertilization has taken place. Fertilization, on the whole, is a very special matter with bees. It is not as though there were a marriage bed somewhere to which they retire during fertilization, but rather the complete opposite takes place. For fertilization, they appear in public, in full sunshine, and specifically, this may seem very strange, they go as high as possible. The queen flies as high as possible toward the sun, to which she belongs. I have described that for you already. The drone, still able to overcome its own earth-based powers, despite the fact that it has unified itself with these powers, flies highest of all and can fertilize the queen way up there in the air. Then the queen comes back again and lays her eggs. You see, bees don't have a nuptial bed. They have instead a nuptial flight. When they want fertilization to take place, they strive as much as possible to fly in the direction of the sun. It is also the case that they need good weather for their nuptial flight. During bad weather, nothing will happen. All this demonstrates how the queen maintains a relationship with the sun. After fertilization has taken place, the workers are produced in the corresponding worker cells. At first, as described to you by Mr. Müller, the little maggots, larvae, develop, which in turn grow into adult workers in 21 days. In these pouch-like cells, a queen develops. In order to gain insight into what follows, I need to tell you something you will naturally at first admit into your thoughts with reservation and doubt, because you would need to spend more time to really study this matter. It just happens to be this way. I need to tie this in with the infertile worker bee we have just discussed. When the worker, having reached maturity, flies out to seek flowers or trees, and can assume a secure position on them by means of its claws, there's a drawing on the blackboard, table 3, page 162, lower right, it then can suck up the honey nectar and collect pollen. It carries the pollen on its body where it has deposited it. There is a special accommodation, the so-called brushes, on its hind legs, where the pollen is deposited. But the honey nectar it sucks up with its proboscis. Part of this honey serves as food for its own digestion, but the greatest portion it retains in its honey stomach. The contents of the latter it will regurgitate when it returns to the hive. So when we eat honey, we are in reality eating the regurgitated product of the bee. We need to be clear about this, however. It is a very pure and sweet form of vomit, not the way such products usually are in nature. So you see, the bee collects what it needs to eat, to store away, or to use in making wax, and so on. Now we need to ask ourselves how the bee finds its way to the blossoms. It makes its way to these blossoms with utter confidence. This is hard to understand if you look at the bee's eyes. The worker, the drones have somewhat larger eyes, has two little eyes on each side and three very small ones on its forehead, drawing on the blackboard, table 2, upper right. If you examine the worker's eyes, you will come to the conclusion that they can see very little, and the three tiny eyes, at least at first, seem to be able to see nothing at all. This is what is so strange. The bee does not approach a blossom by means of sight, but by means of something closer to smelling it. It moves in the direction of the scent, which directs it toward the blossom. What leads the bee to the blossom is a certain sensing ability situated midway between smell and taste. The worker bee already tastes the nectar and pollen as it flies toward the blossom. Even from a distance it can taste it. That has brought the bee into a situation where it does not use its eyes. Now just imagine very clearly the following. Think of a queen bee that has just been born in the realm of the sun, without having completely absorbed all the influences that the total sun cycle of 21 days could offer it. This queen has been held back somewhat in receiving all of the sun's influential powers. A whole army of workers has completed the entire sun cycle of influences, but has not gone over and allowed the earth's influences to take over. Now these workers feel related to the queen, not because they have experienced all the same influences of the sun, but rather because they have remained within the sphere of the sun's cycle of influences. In this regard, their development was the same as the queen's. The drones do not share this parallel development, since they separated themselves from the rest. But now the following takes place. Whenever a new queen is created, a nuptial flight must have preceded this birth. The animal, the queen, has come out into the sun. A new queen bee has been born. At this point, a very strange event occurs for all the workers that feel related to the old queen. Their tiny eyes begin to see at the time when a new queen is born. This is something the bees can't stand. They can't bear the fact that something the same as they themselves is arising from somewhere else. The three tiny eyes of the workers originate from deep within their bodies and are permeated with their inner blood, among other things. These eyes have not been exposed to the external effects of the sun's influence. Because the new queen, having been born of the sun, brings new sunlight into the beehive with her own body, the workers with their tiny eyes suddenly begin to see. I would like to say they become clairvoyant and can't stand to see the light emanating from the new queen. The entire horde begins swarming. It is as if they are afraid of the new queen because she seems to blind them. It would be as though you were looking directly at the sun. This is why they swarm out of the hive. At this point, you must try to establish the beehive again with the old queen, attempting to retain most of the workers that still belong to it. The new queen must attract a new community of bees. A part of the swarm remains behind, but that is the portion that was born under other conditions. The reason bees swarm out of the hive is simply that the workers can't endure the new influence of the sun that the new queen brings into the hive. Now you might ask, why do the bees become so overly sensitive to this new sun effect? Gentlemen, there is a remarkable thing at work here. You know that sometimes meeting up with a bee can turn into an unpleasant experience. It can sting you. Being as large as a human being means that you will usually suffer only an inflammation on your skin, but unpleasant it remains. Little animals can die from the sting. All this derives from the fact that the bee has a stinger that is actually a duct. In this duct, something resembling a piston goes up and down, retrieving from the poison sac the poison it causes to stream downward. This poison, which causes such unpleasant problems for anyone who encounters it, is extraordinarily important for bees. It is not even a pleasant experience for a bee to have to sacrifice the poison while engaged in stinging. The reason it does so is that it has difficulty tolerating all types of external influences. It wants to remain within itself. The bee's world is its own beehive. Every influence from the outside disturbs it. It defends itself against this foreign influence with its poison. But this poison has another significance as well. This poison is present within the bee in such a way that only tiny amounts are absorbed into the bee's body. Looking at the worker's eyes, you can see that these tiny eyes can't see. The reason for this is that poison constantly enters these small eyes. This poison is limited in its effect upon the bee when the new queen, the new sun's influence, is present. The poison loses its effectiveness. Suddenly the eyes can see again. You could say that the bee actually owes to the poison it carries the fact that it lives in a continual twilight. If I should try to give you a picture of what the bees experience when a new queen crawls out of its sac-like cell, I would have to say that a little bee, like the ones we are examining, lives in a continuous twilight. It feels its way about by means of a sense midway between smell and taste, and lives in a twilight that is appropriate for its life as a bee. The appearance of the new queen can be compared to our going out on a dark June night and seeing glowworms, lightning bugs, or fireflies flying about. In the same way, the queen appears to give off light for the swarm of bees, because their poison no longer has an effect strong enough to keep each one within itself. The bee needs to be shut off from the world with a twilight barrier. This barrier it carries along with itself when it flies out, because the poison can help the bee remain within itself. It needs the poison whenever it becomes afraid that something external might attempt to influence it. The whole beehive wants to be completely by itself. So that the queen can remain in the realm of sun influences, it may not be in such a cell with corners, but rather in one with round sides. There it will be totally under the sun's influence. Table 2, middle right. And now, gentlemen, we come upon something that should make everyone become interested in apiculture. Inside the beehive, things basically happen the same way, only with slight differences, as they do in the head of a human being. The only difference is that the substances do not develop and mature as much. In the human head, we have nerves, blood vessels, and also individual protein cells, which remain round. They are always somewhere in there. We have three types of things in the human head. First, we have the nerves, consisting of individual cells, which do not grow and develop into animals because they are covered on all sides by nature. They really want to become little animals, these nerves. If the nerve cells in the human head could develop in all directions like the beehive, then these nerve cells would become drones. Second, the blood cells flowing in the arteries would become worker bees. See drawing below, see also table 3, upper left. Third, the protein cells, particularly those in the middle of the head, having undergone the shortest development, can be compared to the queen bee. So you see, we have the same three powers in the human head. Well, the workers bring home what they collect from the plants, manufacture wax within their own bodies, and then construct these wonderful cells. Gentlemen, this is what the blood cells in the human head do as well. They go from the head into the entire body. If, for example, you look at a piece of bone, you will see everywhere these hexagonal cells. The blood that circulates in the body carries out the same task that the bees do in the beehive. The only difference is that other cells, for example the muscles, where it is also still similar, for muscle cells are also similar to the wax cells of the bees, soon lose their form as they are dissolved. They are still soft, so you don't notice it as much. But if you study the matter more closely, you will notice this form in the bones very clearly. So now we can say that our blood has the same powers that a worker bee has. Yes, gentlemen, you can study this even in connection with time. Those cells that you find developed before everything else in the human embryo, and which then remain the protein cells, are the very cells that are present in the earliest stages of embryonic development. The others, the blood cells, develop somewhat later, and last of all the nerve cells appear. It happens the same way in the beehive, the only difference being that a human being builds up a body that only seems to belong to the individual, and the bee also constructs a body, the honeycomb, the cells. The same things happen with the construction of wax that happen in the forming of our bodies. With the body, it is not easy to prove that the blood cells make it out of a type of wax, but we are made of a kind of wax, just as the bees make their honeycomb in there or in the box. So we can say that it is like this. The human being has a head, and the head works on the entire large body, which actually is the beehive. And the beehive contains within it, in the relationship between the queen and the workers, the same relationship that the protein cells that remain round have with the blood. And the nerves are constantly being ruined. Continually the nerves are being worn out, for we exhaust our entire nervous system. When this happens, we do not immediately engage in a battle of nerves. We would die each year if we did that, the way the bees engage in a battle against the drones. Nevertheless, our nerves become weaker each year. It is actually because of this weakening of the nerves that the human being dies. We are then no longer able to sense the body as well as we once did, and human beings always die because they have frayed their nerves and worn them out. If you now examine the human head, which represents the beehive, you will find that everything in the head is protected. If you bring something forcibly up to it from the outside, there will be a terrible injury. The head can't tolerate it. The beehive also can't tolerate the appearance of a new queen, and would rather leave than try to live with this new queen. It is for this reason that apiculture has always been considered extremely important to human beings. Humans take 20% of the honey away from the bees. You could easily say that this honey is extraordinarily useful to us, because we would otherwise obtain very little honey in all the other food we eat, since it is so sparingly distributed among plants. We would otherwise manage to eat only tiny amounts of honey. We also have bees in us, specifically our blood, which carries this honey to the various parts of the human body. This very same honey is what the bee needs to make wax, from which it can construct its body, the honeycomb of the beehive. Honey has an extraordinarily beneficial effect on humans, particularly when we grow old. With a child, it is milk that acts in this way. Honey assists in maintaining the form of our bodies. For this reason, the consumption of honey is highly recommended for older people. However, it is important not to eat too much of it. If you overeat honey and don't use it to simply garnish other foods, then you will develop too much form. Then the body form will become brittle, and you will contract many diseases. Well, a healthy person senses how much should be eaten. Particularly for older people, honey is an extraordinarily healthy form of nourishment, because it actually gives the body a solidness, a real power of resistance. If you were, therefore, to follow this rule, also with children who have rickets, to be sure you would not do this during the very first weeks of life, when children normally would live only on milk, because honey would not have any effect then. If you gave such a child at about 9 to 10 months of age a properly dosed amount of honey, and then had the child continue this diet until age 3 or 4, the rickets would not become as bad as it would normally be, because the nature of rickets is that it keeps the body too soft, so that it begins to collapse into itself. But honey contains the power to maintain the shape and form of the human body, to give it solidity. You need to gain insight into the interconnections of these matters. You really could say that we ought to pay much more attention to honey production and beekeeping than we currently do. The following is also possible. In nature there are remarkable connections between all things. Those particular laws that people can't comprehend with their ordinary understanding are actually the most important. It is true, isn't it, that these laws operate in such a way as to always allow for a slight amount of freedom or latitude. Take, for instance, the balance between the sexes on Earth. There is not a completely equal number of men and women on Earth, but the number is approximately equal. Over the entire Earth, the number is just about equal. The wisdom of nature controls this. If the time should ever come, I think I told you this before, that we are able directly to manipulate the birth of children by sex and leave the choice to the parents, then the whole matter could immediately become chaotic. Currently the situation is this. If, for example, raging wars have decimated the population in some region, then the population becomes more fruitful and more children are born. In nature, every deficiency, every shortage, calls forth an opposing power. It is also true that when bees seek out honey nectar in a certain region, they remove it from the plants. But they take it away from the plants that we need for other purposes, such as for fruits and so forth. The strange thing is that fruit trees and similar plants thrive better in regions where there is apiculture than in regions where there is not. When the bees remove the honey nectar from the plants, nature does not look idly by, but creates even more fruitful plants. So it is that the human being derives benefits, not only from the honey the bees provide, but also from that which is offered by the plants that bees have visited. This is an important law, into which you can gain deep insight. Connected to all of this is the thought that if you could see to the bottom of things, you could express the following. Nature has placed a truly wonderful wisdom into the entire manner in which a bee society functions. Bees respond to certain powers of nature that are extremely important and really wonderful. That is why you will feel a certain reserve that will keep you from indiscriminately and perhaps crudely trying to put your fingers on these powers of nature. It is still true today that wherever we intrude upon these powers of nature, we tend to make things worse rather than better. but we don't worsen things immediately, since nature has limitations everywhere. Despite these constraints, nature operates in the best way it can. We can remove certain limitations and thereby make things a little easier for nature. We have, for instance, seemingly really helped nature very much in regard to beekeeping by using, instead of the older beehives, the newer type of beehive boxes that are arranged with comfort in mind for both bee and human. But now we come to this whole new chapter concerning the artificial breeding of bees. Gentlemen, you must not believe that I can't understand, even from the standpoint of non-anthroposophic science, that beginning with the very first steps, much can be said for artificially breeding bees, because it does simplify quite a few things. But the strong bonding of a bee generation, a bee family, will be detrimentally affected over the longer period. In certain respects, you will be able to only praise artificial breeding if all necessary precautions are taken, as Mr. Müller described to us. But we'll have to wait and see how things will look after 50 to 80 years. Certain forces that have operated organically in the beehive until now will become mechanized, will in themselves be mechanically carried out. It won't be possible to establish the intimate relationship between a queen bee you have purchased and the worker bees the way it would arise all by itself in nature. But at the beginning, the effects of this are not apparent. Obviously, I would not like to see initiated a fanatic movement against the artificial breeding of bees. Such things should not be undertaken when we know that other, more practical means exist. Being fanatic about this would be about the same as something else I want to tell you about. We could figure out approximately when the Earth's reserves of coal will be exhausted. Then we could decide to extract a smaller amount of coal, so that the reserves would last until the Earth reaches the projected end of its existence. You can't say that you must do this, because you really ought to be optimistic and put some trust in the future. You must then tell yourself, well, all right, we'll rob the Earth of all its coal, which means in reality that we'll rob our descendants of coal. But they will be able to find another source of energy, so that they won't need coal. In the same way, you could, of course, talk about the disadvantages in the artificial breeding of bees. But, nevertheless, it doesn't hurt to be conscious of the fact that by introducing a mechanical, artificial element, we are actually disturbing what nature has produced in such a wonderful manner. Beekeeping has always been considered an activity full of wonder, particularly in earliest antiquity. The bee was regarded as a sacred animal. Why? From the manner in which this revered animal carries out its tasks, you could begin to understand much about how things happen within the human being's body. If you take a piece of beeswax into your hands, you are actually looking at an intermediary product arising from a mixture of blood, muscles, and bones. More precisely, that which lies between the latter three. Humans undergo such a stage of wax production. The wax does not solidify, but rather remains fluid until it can be transformed into blood, muscle, or bone cells. The beeswax that you can see physically is within you in the form of certain powers and energies. When, in olden times, people made candles from beeswax and lit them, they really saw in them a remarkable sacrament. Quote, "This wax burning there before us, we obtained from the beehive. There it was a solid substance. When the fire melts this wax and it evaporates, then the wax takes on the same condition that it has in our own bodies." Unquote. Back then, people sensed in the burning candle wax something in their own bodies that flies toward heaven in a similar fashion. This put them into a special mood of reverence. It caused them to regard the bee as a particularly sacred animal, because it prepared something that the human being must continually prepare within. For this reason, it is also true that the more we go back in time, the more we will find that people revered the existence and conduct of bees. Of course, this was when bees were still in a wild state in nature. People looked upon them as a revelation. Later they were domesticated. but in all the things that occur among the bees, there are truly marvelous riddles. The only way to understand bees is to direct the efforts of our study toward what it is that actually happens between the human head and the rest of the body. Now, I have finished making these comments. Wednesday we will have our next session. Perhaps you will think of some questions to bring up at that time. Mr. Mueller may also think of one thing or another to ask. I wanted to make only these comments, which are not open to doubt because they are based on true knowledge, gained by expending great effort in obtaining these insights. But there still may remain a question of perhaps trying to clarify this matter or that. The end of Lecture 1.